It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, remixing. Everybody get up. Have you ever heard a new song on the radio and thought, wait, I've heard that before? It's kind of like musical deja vu. And take this song, Blurred Lines, by Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams. It was a big hit back in 2013, so it was kind of hard to miss, especially if, like me, you have teenagers at home. Anyway, when I first heard this song, I could have sworn I'd heard it before, but I couldn't quite place it. And then this year, the family of Marvin Gaye won a $7.3 million court case, all because Blurred Lines sounds eerily similar to this. Marvin Gaye's 1977 classic, Got to Give It Up. Let's be honest, this is not an entirely new story. Artists have always borrowed and built off the ideas of others, and even the creators of Blurred Lines admit their song was inspired by Gaye. So what makes this copyright case really interesting is that it falls into the murky space between inspiration and outright imitation. There aren't obvious hooks or melodies that were lifted from Gaye's classic. The percussion and the singing are similar, but does that really count as copying? Where do you draw the line?
There's a long history of sample-related cases going back decades. And that had really been the way that most people understood issues of copyright infringement in music. And so this is something really very different, and that's the main reason why it's so troubling.
Cal Rustiala is a law professor at UCLA. He believes the Blurred Lines decision could have serious negative consequences for musical artists and also for listeners.
There's a couple of things that are problematic. I mean, one is precisely this issue of sounds like. If you think about it, once you open the door to viewing songs as sounding similar to other songs and that being legally actionable, it just opens up an enormous variety of potential lawsuits. And so I think many people who look at music and copyright, both from the music side and from the legal side, are really troubled by the decision in this case. There's just so many songs that draw upon a style or a feeling that somebody else had. And in many cases, that song that's supposedly being copied is itself in many ways drawing upon yet earlier music. And this is the way a lot of creativity works. It builds on prior work and tweaks it and arguably improves it or at least makes it different.
Well, and it's so subjective, right? I mean, sounds like. What is that based on exactly?
It's very subjective. And that's why in the previous cases that really dealt with sampling, it was a little bit simpler because you can say, okay, these, as in one case, these three notes were copied. A string of notes together can be identified. And it's really not that subjective. The feeling or the sounds like test is totally different. And, you know, I would draw kind of a parallel to something like Starbucks and coffee bean and tea leaf. So if the notion is, well, someone came along and took Starbucks coffee shop and kicked it up a notch and made it a little bit different, and then somebody else came along and so on and so forth. In these kind of situations, sure, these coffee shops seem similar. But I think we would have a lot of trouble saying that whoever was first ought to be able to sue whoever was second. I think we think that kind of competition is good and that that's kind of how markets work. You know, people have a good idea and somebody takes it and tweaks it.
Well, this gets tricky, surely, because we're talking about, I mean, somebody could argue that you're trying to compare apples and oranges, maybe a commercial product like a Starbucks. Maybe that's pretty different and should be pretty different from a creative product like a piece of music or a novel.
Well, I would differ on that on a number of grounds. One, I think certainly culinary arts are arts in the same way that musical arts are arts. But if you want to sort of steer away from those kind of parallels and just think about novels, one of the things we do in copyright traditionally is we understand that there's a concept of genre, and we have something called the sens affaire doctrine, which basically says there are certain stock things that are understood to go with a certain type of story. Something like a story involving wizards might have pointy hats and beards. Mm-hmm. So when J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, she was not sued by the J.R.R. Tolkien estate, the writer of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And I think rightly so, because although there, too, there were wizards with hats and beards, it's understood that that's part of what makes a wizard a wizard.
Right. But in that case, Tolkien didn't invent wizards and beards. But if J.K. Rowling had named her world Middle-earth, that might have been copyright infringement.
That might have been. So it really is a question of what's at stake. So likewise, in this case, did Marvin Gaye invent funk music? No. He's a fantastic, or was a fantastic artist, but he himself riffed openly on the work of others who preceded him and acknowledged that.
Yeah. There's this long history of artists who build on the style of their predecessors. I mean, you could argue that pretty much this is the way the arts, the creative arts, works. You know, Rolling Stones borrows from Muddy Waters, Picasso borrows from Cezanne. But I think one reason that so many people were really upset about this ruling is that it seems to ignore the way artistic creativity works and even to redefine and set a kind of chillingly high bar for originality.
I couldn't agree more. I think that we often have a kind of popular understanding of creativity or innovation, even in, say, technology, that really privileges the idea of kind of a eureka moment or a pioneering invention or creative work. And that certainly does happen sometimes. But much more common is work that takes something that already exists and makes it better or makes it different, tweaks it, builds on it, improves it. And we understand that when we talk about ideas like genre or trends, those are things that look alike. That's a series of things that look alike in some way or another. So, you know, you could pick any number of art forms and see that. And so I think that's really at the heart of creative work. And people really are influenced by others and sometimes overtly make that clear. And there's plenty of examples in contemporary music and older music of that. And we've never thought of that as being something that broke the law. We thought of it as, you know, maybe not so original, maybe a little bit derivative. Depends, obviously. It's something that's in the ear of the beholder, but never something that violated the law until this case.
You know, listening to you, it's hard not to think that the entire legal profession is kind of at fault here and that we've carried copyright law to extremes and really have kind of privatized and monetized what should never have been monetized in the first place.
Well, I think there's something to that. I do think that copyright has been taken too far. So in my book with Chris Sprigman, The Knockoff Economy, we kind of explore that concept in a lot of different domains. And I think one of the things that's so interesting about looking at the creative world is that there are many creative arts that are not protected by copyright that are extremely creative nonetheless. And so that calls into question whether we really need this hammer of copyright to foster creativity, which is the ostensible purpose of copyright, to make it possible for people to create in the first place.
Well, it's also interesting what creative products we copyright and what we consider not copyrightable. There's a story you tell about a couple of New York chefs, but maybe you should tell the story of Ed's Lobster Bar.
Sure. So in New York, there's a well-known restaurant called the Pearl Oyster Bar. And at one point, a chef from Pearl, a chef named Ed, went off and opened his own restaurant just maybe a mile away called Ed's Lobster Bar. And there was a kind of legal action taken. In the end, it was settled. There was a legal action taken by the owner of Pearl Oyster Bar, arguing that Ed had taken, essentially copied the look and feel of the restaurant and even copied their iconic and original Caesar salad. So what makes this story so interesting is it gets at this same set of questions we're talking about with regard to music. What's the line between, you know, reasonable homage or derivative works versus something that's against the law? And in the case of cuisine, you can't copyright a recipe. I'll say in my own opinion, Ed's Lobster Bar looked a lot like Pearl Oyster Bar. And I'll also say Pearl Oyster Bar is a better restaurant. But the fact is there was nothing particularly original about Ed's or Pearl's. They all were, in a sense, copies of something further back, which is the traditional New England seafood shack. Mm. And so I think it nicely illustrates the fact that what we do when we create is typically stand on someone else's shoulders and build something slightly better. And that's at the heart of the creative endeavor. That's something to be applauded. It's not something to be sued over.
But on the other hand, I mean, you said you can't copyright a recipe, which maybe is sort of a shame. I mean, for instance, somebody somewhere invented that molten chocolate cake that's everywhere now. So and soon, you know, every upscale restaurant in the country now does a version of molten chocolate cake. Well, whoever invented it is getting no credit and, more importantly, no money. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. We talk about this a bit in the book as well. There's some dispute over who really invented the molten chocolate cake, and it might have been any number of people who just took a cake out too soon and discovered it wasn't fully cooked. But you're right that it spread. In fact, it's in Chili's now. It's not just upscale restaurants. It's everywhere. But I don't think that it's an example of what's wrong with the system. I think it shows that people can continue to create even when their creative works are copied. And the reason is that there's lots of value that comes from being an originator that does not require you to have a monopoly over that creation. So, you know, in the case of cuisine, it's something you really eat in a particular place. And so experiencing the molten chocolate cake in one restaurant versus another is going to be very different. And of course, the cakes are going to vary and people are going to kind of twist and tweak the recipe a little bit here and there. And I think it also proves that chefs continue to be very creative even in the face of this kind of copying. Every good chef knows that his or her work can be reverse engineered by another chef. That's the way restaurants work, and they understand that. But they continue to create nonetheless, and I think that illustrates a point I made earlier. We don't always need copyright law to get people to create. They'll create anyway. And that's what we want in our society, is a creative society that's full of innovation.
So what you're saying is that copying actually drives innovation. To argue the other side, I guess, if we live in a culture that's filled with imitations and remixing, you're suggesting that that's really good for innovation. You could also argue that maybe that's a culture that's a little low on creativity. I mean, right now, you know, you must feel like every time I turn on the radio or listen to music, I hear songs that sound just like all the other songs.
I don't disagree that there are some downsides to this. And I want to be clear on this point. I'm not opposed to having protection for creative works. Mm-hmm. So I believe in copyright and trademark and patent. I think they're very important. I think the question is, what's the right balance? We don't want a society in which everything is just a kind of ripoff of something else. But at the same token, if you don't have some scope for building on what's come before you, that itself can be impoverishing. So it's a question of balance.
Cal Restiala teaches law at UCLA, and he's the co-author of The Knockoff Economy, How Imitation Spurs Innovation.